Because there is this ceremony on Monday, the subject of these of the ceremony and what it involves and the meaning of it have been very present for me. And actually that ceremony and that subject touches on the essence of this practice anyway. So I thought I would look at it a bit today with you, and then we'll see if there are further questions, if we want to change and discuss something else, whatever. But I would like to introduce just basically this, what it is. The point of the practice, the point of the ceremony and the meaning of it, very simply, is just to live our life fully, harmoniously, and freely. This sounds nice. Sounds okay, simple. What's the big deal? All of these words, harmony, freedom, full, what do they mean? What does our life mean? What does it mean to live our life in fully, harmoniously, freely? All of these questions are very important and are dealt with in this ceremony, this ritual, and are dealt with in this practice in general. You've heard me mention several times now, since yesterday, different aspects of life. This morning I talked about the personal and then the impersonal. Most of the time, our attention is focused on the personal aspect of our life and on the what we might call the limited aspect. We experience ourselves and others according to this perspective. I am 52 years old. I am a woman. He is 21 years old. He is a man. He is tall. She is short. He is smart. She is smarter. All of these categories, distinctions, differences, appearances, that's usually how we function. And in our world, we have to. It's very important. That's our world. When I came here, I had to show my passport. And I am identified on that passport by all of these categories and distinctions. If I didn't show the passport, they wouldn't allow me on the airplane. So I'm really limiting myself, my ability to function in the world, if I don't take into consideration that aspect of reality. In the same way, I'm limiting myself if I only focus on that aspect of reality. If I miss the point that, okay, I am of American origin, I am dual French-American citizen, you are Portuguese, you probably have your own stories, they're Brazilian, French, we have different categories, different differences here. But we are all one. Those differences don't make us different. essentially, fundamentally, our nature is the same. And if we focus only on those differences, well, then we end up with wars, economic disarray, nuclear catastrophes, fights with our spouses, disputes with someone in the line at the post office, any number of sufferings, we say. Because we're missing the oneness, we're missing the interconnections that we have. We're seeing only the differences. So when we say the point is to live fully, we're talking about living with those two aspects fully integrated into our lives. It's not easy because our mind functions in a dual way. It's either black or it's white. It's either American or it's Portuguese. It's either short or tall. And those are just very basic differences. We make far more subtle differences and far more meaningful differences than that. Among them being me, you, existing, non-existing, life, death. And if we, as long as we make those differences and stick to one side or the other, we say we create suffering. We create problems for ourselves, difficulties for ourselves, and for others. Because usually we try to impose our view on others. Even if it's not overtly saying, I want you to see what I see. It's more, I want you to be like I want you to be. Mm-hmm. Or I don't want you to be like the way I don't want you to be. So what we call now the precepts in this practice were guidelines that were developed 2,500 years ago by the original teacher of this lineage, the one we call the Buddha, so that his community and the people who were practicing and studying with him could function fully, harmoniously, and freely. The guidelines that he developed applied very specifically to a certain group of people at a certain place and a certain time in a specific context. What we have today as guidelines are this same spirit, have that same spirit with that same intention. However, they apply in a different context, in a different time, to a different group of people. One of the guidelines that the Buddha had in his group was that his people were not allowed to wear cotton or have any cotton materials, bedding, cushions, clothing, whatever. Because at that time, in that context, cotton was considered a luxurious tissue material. And he didn't want his people to have anything special. He wanted them to be just ordinary, which is what we are trying to do too. And so he didn't want them to have something that ordinary people would not have. So, no karma. Today, that doesn't apply. Cotton is very ordinary. We don't really even think about it much of the time. And there's a story that applies to this. In the community that my lineage originated with in America in the 1960s, a monk from a group that still practices those precepts of the Buddha, one of them being not having any cotton, came to visit this Zen center where my practice originated in America. And all of the people in the group in America thought, oh, okay, he can't have any cotton, but all of their cushions and seats, sheets, everything was in cotton. So it became a very big project to make special things for him, to find sheets that had no cotton. And almost all sheets in the store had cotton. They were blends. So they ended up buying some very exclusive silk sheets. And they had to make a special cushion for him. And they had to make a special seat for him. The spirit of the guideline was completely turned on its head. The meaning was lost. The point was to not be anyone special. And here they turned him into this very special being with these exclusive tissues and things that were only for him. They made him different than themselves. This seems obvious, right? Everyone gets this. Well, the same thing applies all the time. And some of these guidelines that we have, they're not laws. It's not a law. It's not like the speed limit is 120 kilometers an hour. Or you must pay your taxes. It's not a law. They're guidelines. So one of them is, I vow to refrain from not killing. So I make this vow to not kill. It's impossible to maintain that law. It's not a law. So it's impossible to not even follow that guideline entirely, because simply by living, I am killing. The cells in my body are dying and being born something like 77,000 times a second. It's enormous. If there are scientists here, they might know better than me. But simply by being alive, I'm killing. There are some, these same people who don't use cotton today, also are very precise trying not to step on insects on the ground. They really try to not kill with every step they take. This is a limited view, right? Ultimately, there's another perspective. We can say, as I said, we are always killing. In order to eat, we have to kill. Even if it's not an animal, it's a plant. We have to. That's part of our human condition. And there's a third perspective, which would be, there is no killing. There is nothing. There is no birth, there is no death, There is no you, there is no me. Nothing. This sounds very conceptual to you. Doesn't matter. I'm telling you the different possibilities. The only way to know these possibilities, other than conceptually, is to experience them. And you've experienced the first two perspectives that I've said. Of course you know that, well, right, it makes perfect sense. You have to eat, and so, of course, you have to kill. You have to make exceptions. It depends on the context. Of course you know also that you don't want to kill your neighbor. Or you might want to when they're having a loud party and you're trying to sleep at 3 a.m. or whatever. Ultimately, you understand that. The third aspect we're not so familiar with because we don't function in our world with that third aspect. It's okay. It doesn't matter. Now, how does this apply when these people, they come to do the ceremony and they take these vows? What does this mean? As I said, I think I said it, they are acknowledging that they want to live their life in the most harmonious way possible. And they are recognizing that these guidelines will help them. And they are acknowledging that it's impossible to maintain them, but that is their intention. And that these will help them to stay focused. They will serve as reminders. They are also acknowledging that these guidelines are just expressions of their true nature, of who they are, of who they truly are, and that their life is this awakened life. And we practice so that we can deepen our experience of these three perspectives, I said, because all of the perspectives are valid. If we only see the restrained, the limited perspective, no killing. There's problems. No cotton. Problems. If we only see the aspect of, well, it really depends, it doesn't matter, you can use cotton if you want to, everybody kills, no problem. If we only see that, there's a problem. And if we only see the aspect of, there is no one to kill, there is no one to be killed, there is no cotton, there is no silk, there is no cushion. If we only see that, there's problems too. It only works when the three function together. And it functions together naturally. But with our mind that sticks on one or the other, we create problems. So we practice in order to become aware of those three aspects and function freely with them without causing the least amount of difficulty for ourselves and others. Okay? When I say difficulty, I mean pain, suffering, harm, dissatisfaction. The basic difficulty that we sense in our everyday life, not necessarily linked to one thing. And the way that these precepts function, there is really no solid ground. An example, when I was growing up, it was during the Vietnam War, when American soldiers were fighting in Vietnam, and my brother was of the age that he could have been called to serve, because it was not a volunteer army. There was a draft and people had to go. My brother, it was done by a lottery, and his number was high enough so that he didn't have to go, at least for a while. But he had a friend whose number was quite low and would have had to go. And he didn't want to go. He didn't believe in this war, he didn't want to kill, and he really deeply was going to refuse to go. So he was going to flee to Canada, which is what a lot of young men did, American men did. But before that, he had to hide. It was a process of going. And my father accepted to have him stay at our house for a brief time. Now, we could say my father was breaking the law. He was prepared, my father, that if someone came looking for him, my father was prepared to lie, to say he's not here. Although my father himself, as a young man, had served in Europe in the Second World War and had been a soldier, had witnessed killing, had probably killed himself. And his father had been in the First World War and gone through the same thing. So he was aware of what killing was. He was aware of what war was. I don't know, I was too young to discuss it with him, but I think I can understand that he believed that in this case, lying was the lesser of the evils, if you want to call it, or the lesser of the precepts that he would break. He didn't follow these precepts, but the lesser of the guidelines in his life. So, in that case, what do we do? If we lie, we are violating a precept. If we don't lie, we are encouraging killing. I don't know, what do you do? In every situation, there is something different. A more extreme situation is the one that I often say of, in the 1930s or 40s in France, a Jewish family comes to hide in your house, and then the Gestapo comes knocking at your door. Do you lie and say, no, there's no, I have no one here? Or do you say, oh no, I can't lie, that's the precept, I must tell the truth, and then these people are taken away and killed. What do you do? It always depends. There's no firm ground. Which seems to make it difficult to follow these precepts, these guidelines. It is if we have fixed positions, if we have fixed ideas. If we come to the moment with no fixed idea about this or that, me, you, right, wrong, good, bad, it's just what it is. I don't know. I don't know if it's good or bad. I'm just here with it, with what is. I acknowledge all of it. I acknowledge the situation. And whatever arises then will be what we say the right action, or we sometimes say loving action. It comes from a place not of harm, but of help. Help not in a positive sense. It's not like someone who always does good. It might not look good. Sometimes it involves yelling at your child. It's not always being happy and letting the child do whatever he wants. It might be often we hear of these situations where there are, unfortunately, we hear these of someone coming into a school with a gun and shooting people or something. And often there is someone, just an ordinary person, who intervenes and tackles the person or shoots him or hits him or something. That's loving action, but it's not pretty. It's not what we think of as giving someone a hug or saying, oh yes, it's fine, do whatever you want. There's something that needs to be done. And because we don't have a fixed position about it, we can act appropriately. We have these guidelines to help us understand what is appropriate. So one of them is vowing to not talk about other people's errors and faults. This is a big one. We love to talk about someone else who made a mistake. Someone else did something wrong. They were bad. And we love to talk about this. It's kind of juicy to do this. So one of these precepts is I vow to try not to do that. Why? Well, ultimately we can say there are no errors. There are no faults, ultimately. Because that's a relative term. One person's error is another person's beauty. Right? We can also say that the other person's errors are mine. This person is just another aspect of myself, and I have those same errors. This person is just expressing something that I do myself sometimes. I have that same potential. When I went to Auschwitz and did a retreat at Auschwitz, I experienced the possibility, the potential in myself to do the same thing. To put people away and destroy them because they don't fit my view of how they should be. They're different than me, so they don't deserve to live. I have this possibility, and I do it. Of course, I don't send them to a gas chamber, but I might not even pay attention to someone because there's no interest in that person. Absolutely uninteresting. Or I don't like the shoes he's wearing. Or I might have the opposite. I really like his shoes, so I want to be his friend. Or he's like me. Or we all support the same football team. Or he doesn't like my football team, so I don't like him. You know, these are basic things. Or political parties. Now you, in Portugal, you have big things going on there. And so, you know, the people on the left are losers, they screw everything up. Get them out of here, forget it. Let's go back with the right. On the other hand, the right, those guys are just fascists, you know, forget it, they're conservatives, they'll just serve the rich, they're corrupt, they've been benefiting from everybody's money all along anyway, or they're all corrupt. Get them all out, let's just have the European community take care of our economy, or have the World Bank take care of it. Portuguese people can't do it, you know, you have all kinds of stuff around this. So we are constantly judging and indulging in this criticizing other people's errors and faults. When ultimately, there are no errors. It's just what it is. There can be something really interesting, and I'll stick with this Portuguese economic situation because it's familiar to all of you. There's something interesting in that. There's something very telling in that. I read an article about the Portuguese highways, and this was in a French newspaper, Le Monde. Beautiful highways. Right? You all know the story. But the article, something I didn't know, was that I hadn't thought about, that throughout the history of Portugal, there's always been something around transportation and transport, and always really high quality transportation. You know, the great discoverers who went out into the world in these beautiful boats and had access to the world that other people didn't really. And the article maybe had some other examples, I don't know, but I thought that was very interesting. What does that say about this people? What does that say? And the article said Portuguese have always put a big importance on transport, and yet they don't really bring anything back for themselves. And they don't apply it, that same savoir-faire, let's say, in not getting around, but just being. I'm kind of interpreting what the article said, but that was what it said. Some of you are laughing. Maybe that speaks to you. Maybe it does. I don't know. But so there are interesting things in this situation. And what can be learned from that? And how can that neurosis, every neurosis has an enlightened side. Mm-hmm. How can that be transformed? How can the qualities, because everything we think of as a fault is also a quality. And usually the same thing that makes us stumble is what can make us rise. The same thing. If we don't stick to one view, one position about ourselves and about others. So these precepts are just that, just guidelines for that. Opening to the fullness of our life. Just as it is. You don't have to be anyone other than who you are. You can't be anyone other than who you are. So, may as well give it up now, because you could spend your life trying it to be someone else, but it won't happen. So, So we have these three aspects then of the precepts. One is the fundamentalist aspect that I told you, the literal aspect. Kill, not kill. Very basic. This is the fundamentalist, and we all know fundamentalists in many domains. Often we talk about it in terms of religion, because religious fundamentalists are very enthusiastic and make their presence known. But that is an aspect of reality, this fundamentalist, very literal aspect, concrete, basic aspect. And then we have the subjective aspect, which is the compassionate aspect, in which things are nuanced. There is black and white, but there's gray. There are differences. We acknowledge the differences, and we see that it's not only those differences. And then we have the intrinsic aspect, which is, as I said, not one or the other. No differences, no gray areas. We call this the emptiness aspect, or the Buddha aspect. And each of those aspects is true. And the challenge is to function taking into account those three. It doesn't mean that we are constantly observing to see, oh, which aspect am I seeing now? If we are doing that, we are separate from the moment. Mm-hmm. And because there is, you're looking confused, because there is someone who is observing something else. So there's a separation. We are not just acting. We are just not in the moment, one with it. When we are sitting on our cushion, for example, I said last night, we're not fixing on a point on the ground, because if we're concentrating on something, that implies a separation. It's important to do that at some point to stabilize our mind. Ultimately, however, the idea is to close that separation, to not be separate from this moment, from just what is. Now, if Fatima the cook had a fixed idea about she wants to stay and hear what's being said, that she must stay and hear what is being said, and Miguel too, they would not get up and go cook the meal. There's differences. There's the circumstance demands something different, right? They don't have a fixed idea. They are just like us. We are all the same here. But they have something different they have to do at this moment. Another point about these precepts is that it's a constant, endless process. So because the circumstances are always changing and the moment is always changing, our relationship to the precepts is also changing. So we often say it's like a glass. We want the glass to be clean. So some people, you know, I'm sure you know people like this or have mothers like this or something, where we want it to be clean so we don't use it. I knew people when I was a child who had entire rooms in their house that never got used because they didn't want it to get dirty. Well, then we're not really living, right? If we say, okay, we won't do anything because we don't want to break the precepts. What kind of life is that? That's not a full life. That's not a harmonious life. That room is not even being used. There's no life in that room. With a glass, we use it. And when by using it, we make it dirty. And then we clean it. And then we use it again. So, we live our life, we eat, we kill something. We can acknowledge that. We can be aware of that. And we can choose to minimize the suffering that we cause with what we eat. The Tibetan Buddhists, have an interesting approach to this. In Tibet, in the Tibetan plateau, there isn't much to eat. Not a lot grows. It's very limited. They have no problem eating meat, therefore, the Tibetans. And Tibetan monks eat meat. They're not vegetarian. But their position is they only eat it if it was not killed just for them. Or they didn't go kill it with the intention of killing. They're only eating it because it sustains their life, which allows them to practice and therefore limit the suffering in the world. They accept that there's a certain amount of suffering because it helps to limit other sufferings. Again, it depends on the context. Someone who, I know people who were vegetarians, and because they had problems with anemia, they had to eat meat. So they accepted that. They were vegetarians for moral or ethical reasons, not because they liked it better or something. But so they had to break that precept that they were trying to interpret that way because it meant that their life could be sustained. You see how it's endless, the circumstances, the situations, the moment. Every moment is different. And by participating in this ritual and accepting to take these precepts, to take these vows, these people are acknowledging that. They're acknowledging the complexity and appreciating it. We can appreciate the complexity. Which means simply appreciating our life. The complexity is our life. Your life, just as it is the perfect life. There's no other life than that. So, if you have questions, this is a possibility, this is a moment for them, or comments about this or something else.
In the example that you gave, your father helping your brother's friend, how would you say that the three perspectives would be? For example, the literal perspective would be not lying and...
Right, well, he was lying. So, yeah. According to the literal perspective, he was not respecting the precept.
And the subjective would be the compassion,
right.
Thinking about...
Right, the compassionate aspect, the... In this situation, in this particular situation, in this moment, with this person, this applies differently.
And the third one?
And the third one, well, there is no lying. There is no lying. He was just doing what he was doing. There's no... Not even a question of lying or not lying. It's just what it is. Now, I give that example. My father had knew nothing about these precepts. He was not even, he was raised himself as a Protestant. As a Christian, he didn't even go to church, or he had no sort of spiritual practice, so... It wouldn't have meant anything for him, but he was acting according to them anyway, according to the situation anyway, which we all do anyway.
Mm-hmm. According to that there is no life, there is no death, you explained, so to accept these precepts, you live the funny life, the perfect life, the life you have. Compared to the third aspect, there is no life, there is no death. How can you explain it?
Well, again, it can't be explained in a manner that is satisfactory for our intellect, because it doesn't fit with an intellectual or conceptual understanding. It can only be experienced. What it means, it's like when I said about the lying. There is no lying or not lying. There's just a word that is being said or not said, and even just a word. There is not even a word. In terms of life and death, as soon as we say life, we are setting a barrier. We are setting it opposed to something else. As soon as we say death, we are also setting up a barrier, setting it opposed to something else. It's just what it is. It's difficult for us to see this when we're talking about life and death, because we are so fixed on our concept of what it is to be alive and what it is to die. We have very firm belief of what that is. But as I said, in our body at this moment, we are living and dying. We're manifesting life and death entirely at this moment. It's not one or the other. It's both, entirely. And finding the separation of which is which, it's impossible. Because the cell that is... I said dying, is also regenerating. And it's a process of dying and birthing that is ongoing, that has no limits. We can't fix the limits. So when we say no birth, no death, what it means is no fixed who is born, who dies, when. Of course, we can say that there is a moment when there is a last breath, or there's a moment when there's a first breath. But that when that first breath is taken, that baby is already dead, is already dying. Where is the limit? The example I give, which is sometimes more clear, is a beach. So where does the ocean begin and the beach end? And where does the ocean end, and where is the difference? Where is the separation? We can't see it. Or night and day. Where is the separation? In this context, there is no night and no day. There is no ocean and beach. There is no life and death. It's all one. If we only stick to that point of view, we will be lost. Because as human beings, we can't function without the other. It's as if we're trying to walk on one leg. We have to have both. We have to be in contact and aware of the other aspect. Here is the beach, and here is the ocean. This is day. When the sun goes down, it's night. But this idea of the sun going down is fictive, because it's where it depends where you are. Somewhere else, the sun is fully there. So, those are relative terms, but they are absolutely necessary for us to function fully. Because that's our human form, is a relative, limited form. But the beauty and the marvel of this human form is that it fully manifests both aspects of reality. It fully represents form, is emptiness, we say, is this non-form. And the non-form is fully this form. This body is just an amazing example of what we're talking about. But it's obvious, of course. All we need to realize is who we are. That's all. There's nothing else. There's nothing else. There's no secret. It seems like it, though, because we don't see it. We're walking around with this absolute treasure, rich beyond imagination. And we're looking around trying to accumulate money and cars and houses and beautiful partners and important jobs and fame, security. We're pushing other people out of the way so we can get that what they have. We are talking about their errors so we feel better about ourselves. When in fact, each one of us is the jewel that we're looking for. This, you are it. So, I can tell you that all day, but you have to experience it. It's like a tree or plant, you know, we call it in French a tuteur, something that you put to hold the plant so that it grows straight. You know? But the point is the plant growing. It's not the stick that's holding it up. You know, if we focus on my words are just like that stick. You know, they're not it.
Is this realization a process? Going to use it a process, or is something that happens for no reason?
Both. And neither. Again, according to relative perspectives and who's talking and which school and which interpretation, there are different ways of expressing it. This Zen school happens to be what we call the sudden school, where this very moment is it. And at any moment, you just open your eyes and you see. You see what is. You see things as they are. At any moment. There's no requirements, no preparations, no one special. You don't even need to be able to read and write. Doesn't matter how old you are, what your job is, nothing. Just now. some other schools have a gradual approach. The Tibetans, for example, lifetimes, mantras, endless, hundreds and thousands of mantras and steps and processes and visualizations and offerings and devotions and all kinds of rituals, a lot of different things. However, it comes down to the same thing. It's always situated in a particular place and time. This moment. It's always in this moment. Can we make that happen? Even all of the mantras and all of the hours of sitting, some people think if they sit a lot, it'll happen. Do a lot of retreats, it will happen. It being what? It becomes a concept even. It will happen. It is always happening. It's right in front of your eyes. It is your eyes, in fact. Ultimately, though, it doesn't depend on any of that. And as the teacher of my teacher's teacher used to say, it's an accident. But practice is a way of creating circumstances where accidents happen. Because you are sitting down, taking a posture that is representative of what you're looking for, just you, doing nothing special, stable, allowing things to be as they are. You take that posture and you sit there. This is favorable to accidents happening because you don't have all of your usual controls and barriers and guidelines and everything put into place and expectations. Of course, you have all that. But by sitting stable, being here, limiting the distractions, it's possible to let those things fade away a bit, and something else then can emerge. Zeb?
Yes, it is, but so there's maybe there's different degrees of realization. So you're talking about one that's absolute and will never go away.
No, I'm not.
But I wonder if it can happen that, you know, sometimes there's an opening and then it closes again and then it's open. And so is there a definite opening that will never go away?
This is one of our big illusions, that eventually we'll accept that everything changes. Everything's impermanent, right? We understand that. Yeah. But the one thing that we think is permanent is that.
That's what they call lightning or something.
Right. And we think of that as being permanent.
Yeah.
How can enlightenment, just being seeing things as they are, seeing the impermanence, how can that be permanent?
It's understanding, I guess, no?
How can understanding be permanent? Everything's changing at every moment. And understanding means understanding that. However, there's always a however. Because things are always changing. Nothing is fixed. As you say, there are degrees. And once you have seen, but really it's experiencing. Once you have experienced something, you've experienced it. That experience does not stay, but what your experience of it does. So once you've tasted water, you know what water tastes like. But you have to drink it again and again. But you know what it tastes like. So that's what, if something stays, that's it. But it's not that it stays, it's just what you are. And what you are is changing all the time. So.
Yeah. Relacionado a las experiencias que están en la muerte y la guerra.
You got the experiences of death and war.
death and war.
Eu tenho uma opinião acerca disso, que a pessoa que mata o soldado tem que ter o sangue do inimigo que morre, o suposto inimigo nas mãos, e sentir o cheiro e o sabor e ter a realidade da morte ali à frente.
He has to feel the other person, the death and the blood, the flesh, the, he has to have this experience, to feel the other.
Não é como o piloto que vai lá em cima, carrega no botão, mata milhões e depois chega a casa, fuma um cigarro e bebe uma cerveja. Não tem consciência daquilo que fez.
He has to be closer, not like the soldier who is pilot.
Modern warfare. Yeah.
And doesn't have any contact, so it's more easy for him to, at the end of what he did, at the end of the day, just forget.
Se houver alguma dignidade na guerra ou na morte, ou em quem mata, ou em quem morre, tem que, na minha opinião, tem que ser assim. A pessoa tem que notar o sangue do outro na mão. Tem que sentir o sabor. Que ele tenha uma experiência.
And so we think that if there's any dignity or anything that is more valuable, it's the one who contacts, who has the contact with the enemy, the person who is dying, the one who is closest.
Em Portugal existe uma tradição que é a matança de porco. Não sei se as pessoas aqui alguém conhece. Existe, é usual do norte a sul. Existe um facto muito importante na matança de porco.
There's a tradition in the north of Portugal, which is killing a ritual to kill
a swine.
A swine.
Yeah. Então, quando se ajuda a matar nas aldeias, principalmente agora na Brasília, de forma ordinária, eles chamavam os homens da aldeia, os amigos, ou os mais respeitados, para matar o porco.
So they would, this would take place mostly in villages, and they would call the men who lived in these villages to come and do this killing.
E normalmente o matador é sempre uma pessoa respeitada na aldeia, todos gostavam.
Não, não, the person who was in charge of killing was someone respected in the village.
Ele gosta de estar a falar com o sangue do porco, suja o braço todo. Fica todo cheio de sangue, ele corre por baixo abaixo, em direção ao alguidar. Mas a uma determinada altura, passavam uns anos depois de ter matado muitos porcos, quando ele está experiente e sabe como aquilo se faz, com a maior das facilidades. Ele tenta...
So this man, the man who is responsible for killing, normally, in the beginning, he would get the blood in his arm from the animal, and then... Put him down?
Sim, depois de muitos anos, ele quer passar a faca para o outro, para um jovem.
After doing it, for many years, this person wanted to pass it over to a younger person.
Então ele mente, diz que já não consegue acertar no coração do porco, mas é mentira, é inconsciente.
So
ele não quer fazer aquilo mais.
He doesn't want to do it anymore, in fact, and so he lies and he says that to the village, and he says that he can't do that.
Não consegue, já matou.
Yes, he cannot do that anymore, and so he tells that.
Já tem consciência, já não consegue. O inconsciente dele já não permite espetar mais uma vez a faca e sujar-se com esse sangue. E foi uma realidade muitas vezes que ele passou. É uma experiência direta que ele já não quer ter mais. A morte na mão, por isso é que tem que estar o sangue. A pessoa tem que sujar e provar o que está matando.
Okay, understood. So I think what he's trying to say is because he had seen so many times and he had touched the blood of the animal, he had felt the animal and the death, and so that's why at some point he couldn't do that anymore.
He'd experienced it directly.
Yes. So he's, I think he's saying that you need to feel it in order to and know what it is in order to. Decide not to do anything.
Everyone follow this.
Na minha opinião, se as pessoas fossem obrigadas a matar os porcos, os animais que comem is the prime vegetarian to come here.
So he said that if people had to kill the animals they eat, probably they would be more vegetarian.
Well, and this brings to the point of if we, you know, it's like the room that we don't live in, where there's no life. We can't possibly practice these precepts because we're not living, we're not experiencing life. And when Norberto's example of killing and then therefore choosing not to kill, we say that these precepts are not anything outside of ourselves. They're just what naturally arises from our direct experience of life. Mm. When we allow ourselves to fully experience life, naturally we won't want to kill, because we've experienced, maybe we haven't experienced to that extent.
I never do it. I see.
Exactly. Right. I understand. So when we see that the homeless person in the street is me, when I see that there is no difference between us, that's just another aspect of myself, of course I will help them. I wouldn't want to kill that person because it's me. In the same way that the man who was killing the pigs didn't want to do it anymore. He had fully seen it. And this point of modern warfare, where the people doing the killing are up in airplanes using machines, sophisticated machines that tell them where to drop the bomb, of course it's easy. This is our continued effort to separate ourselves from suffering, rather than acknowledge the suffering in ourselves and in the others. So in this modern warfare, we don't want to experience the suffering of killing, and we don't want to experience the suffering of the one who is killed. So we make it very distant. We do the same thing in our everyday lives. It's not just in modern warfare. So this is what, and it's an interesting point to suggest that in the ceremony that we will do on Monday, before they receive the precepts, there is an aspect which we call atonement. Do you have a word for that in Portuguese? Atonement? Mm-hmm. Anybody know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's to become, to acknowledge, what is it in French? Repentir.
Atonement comes from becoming as one.
That's, well, but it's used in the sense of, it is, it's at one-ment. In English, it's a very happy at one-ment. In French, we would say repentir, it has a very guilt-laced, it has a moral aspect, but it's the notion of acknowledging when I have broken these precepts, acknowledging that I have killed. It's the equivalent of getting your arms splattered with the blood and realizing what it means and acknowledging that you did it and that therefore you don't want to do it anymore. It's the equivalent of, that's why I say it. It means to become one with your errors and faults, to acknowledge that you kill, you lie, you steal, you are greedy. It's to acknowledge these things, but acknowledge them not in a judgmental way. To just acknowledge, to become one with them, not separate. So instead of killing from an airplane and dropping a bomb on anonymous people, you acknowledge that you're doing that. You see it fully. And probably it's true if more soldiers were aware of that, they might not do it. If the people sending the soldiers to do it were more aware of that, they might not do it. Probably my father, part of the reason that he chose to help that boy was because he had experienced it himself at that same age. So we have this first aspect of atoning, means to acknowledge, to recognize my, that I have done this, or I have the potential to do it. And that's a very important aspect.